Okay, Mr. Ashton, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Rudy Ashton. I was appointed to represent Mr. Pelligi on this second appeal. I believe this was the same panel that heard the first appeal several years ago. This case has gone on for a while. I believe the indictment was in 06. The trial verdict was in January of 08. In September of 08, Mr. Pelligi received a sentence of 600 months with a restitution order of $3,900,000 from Judge Whitney. The opinion in this court came down in January of 2010 and basically remanded the case for resentencing, finding the 600-month sentence was procedurally unreasonable because it was based on erroneous facts related to insurances provided in the extradition treaty. It was also remanded to be decided by a different judge, and it was reassigned to Chief Judge Robert Conrad. The case came on for resentencing in December of 2010. He reduced the sentence to 300 months, I believe, entered a restitution order of a little over $4 million at that time, but kept the restitution open and finally had another hearing in August of 2011 and upped the restitution to $20,726,000. And there was two notice of appeal filed, but of course the first one after the original sentence was moved up to in August, and sort of here we are. The first issue is whether the judge should have allowed a second pre-sentence report. And a little background on that, I think what happened, there was a new lawyer who handled the appeal who went back for the resentencing. And on October 7th of 2010...
You weren't representing him at resentencing.
No, I believe Mr. Abrams did the first appeal and went back at resentencing. Okay. And then I've got that after the second sentencing. And I believe what seems to have occurred, it's under seal for whatever reason, but the government filed a sentencing memorandum in October 7th of 2010 asking that the restitution be raised to something over $20 million. Mr. Abrams then filed two motions, one to set aside the judgment because the loss amount was incorrect, and second, for an updated, corrected pre-sentence report. And the basis for that is if the government's now seeking $20 million, he wants to get into the loss amount. There were some changes with personal financial different conditions, and he thought that the probation office ought to prepare another sentence report for this. And Judge Conrad, when he got it, he first decided that the motion to set aside the verdict was denied because it was not contemplated in the mandate from this court, that this court basically sent the case back for resentencing on the 600-month sentence. And so he denied that, said the loss amount wasn't raised during the first appeal. There were no evidentiary issues on the first appeal. The first appeal basically had to do with the 600-month sentence. And with that in mind, I think there's really no argument on the loss amount and things of that nature, except I think Mr. Abrams probably determined, well, if they're going to hear that, the restitution, they ought to hear the other. Well, our position is if Judge Conrad found the mandate prevented him from going into any of these other issues, likewise, it should have prevented him from going into the restitution issue. And if he was going to go in the restitution issue, he should have ordered maybe an addendum to the pre-sentence report. And I understand this is an abuse of discretion standard, but under these circumstances, if he was going to get into a full hearing on everything, we certainly think that a new pre-sentence report or addendum should have been helpful. There's not much case law in the Fourth Circuit on that, so I believe this court can fashion some type of decision that may address when a district court judge should order an addendum or a new pre-sentence report. And so that gets us to the restitution issue and the dramatic increase from about $4 million up to over $20 million. And on page 15 of my brief, I tried to list basically the different dates when the restitution came in. There was a forfeiture of $8,398,000 found by the jury. I think forfeitures and restitution are somewhat different. But our positions on the dramatic increase in the restitution is, first, that the judge did not have authority to hear that. This court sent it back basically just to look at the 600-month sentence. The restitution issue was not addressed by this court. The government did not cross-appeal it. I understand that the Dolan case has to do with the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, and I believe it allowed the government to have a belated restitution figure, but that was more of a matter of months, and it also had an addendum to the pre-sentence report. So Dolan's factually a lot different than this. This is a matter of years, going from 06 when the indictment came down, 08 for the trial and sentencing, and then 2010 when we finally had the second hearing upon remand. And so our position on that is this extraordinary delay was not merely procedural, but more basically a substantive delay, and the judge should not have considered this very, very dramatic increase in the restitution figure. The government, in its brief, argues there may be some exception to this if there's a serious injustice to victims. And I certainly understand that this is a case where many victims were seriously impacted. But then again, it's the government's case. And the indictment was in 06, the trial was in 08, sentencing sometime later. There was a lot of time to get these figures together well before the second appeal came back on remand. And I think of importance there is the agent, Tara Singh, who testified for the government about this increased amount. If you look at pages 235 and 236 of her testimony, she basically testified that although she was not an employee back in 06 and 08 when this occurred, that those figures were available. Apparently, when the case was remanded, they then asked her to come in after the fact and look through all of these documents, and I believe took her several months maybe to go through to come up with the $20 million figure. But the important thing is these facts and figures, according to her at least, were available to the government back before, during the trial, and certainly before the resentencing. And so,
what's your best argument that the court had no authority to address anything on resentencing other than the amount of imprisonment?
I think basically sort of the mandate rule, what you have is Judge Conrad applied the mandate rule on whether he could revisit the issues as to loss amount and the sentencing, because this court didn't address it and they weren't raised on appeal. So the loss amount, all that, the guidelines, the evidentiary issues were not raised on the first appeal and therefore they were waived. And he applied that when Mr. Abrams filed a motion to set aside the verdict and get into those issues after the government had raised it. I think the other argument then is if the mandate rule applied to that, it also apply to this restitution.
Well, do you figure. Think that general rule has been watered down or changed in any way by Judge Agee's opinion in Susi 2 SUSI? United States versus
Susan. Well, the government didn't raise that. Yeah, the Yamas decision, some of that with these call centers and relevant conduct and things, relevant conduct in which call centers actually apply. And our position on that is it seems sort of after the fact that the government is saying, well, in Yamas, the restitution figure had to go down because it initially had to do with all the call centers, but now it's only the Kearns call center. But in this case, all of a sudden, you've got all the restitution figures for all the centers is $4 million, but when it comes just to Pelleges centers, after all these figures are run several years later, it goes up to $20 million. And I guess the point we're trying to make is the government should have had all these figures in the first place. And so we don't think Yamas basically applies here, or certainly after the fact, to go back and say, well, the $4 million had to do with all the centers, but the $20 million has to do with only the Kearns Call Center. It doesn't follow logically that it would go up that dramatically when it was reduced from all the call centers to the one call center.
Well, what is your understanding of why Judge Conrad went back into the issue of restitution?
The only thing I can determine is that the government filed the motion before the remand hearing to revisit that. Mr. Abrams objected all the way through to all the new figures. And I guess Judge Conrad, all I can fathom is that he thought, since the case was sort of ongoing, they could continue to consider restitution figures. But it's our position that that should have been resolved at the first sentencing hearing. It was not in the mandate of this court to get back into restitution. And again, that dragged on for another 8 months. And I think our last argument is basically the witness that testified. Mr. Abrams took the position it was insufficient evidence to support the award, but more importantly, again, all of that evidence was available several years before, and then have that sprung on them 4 years later and come out with a figure that's about five times as much as. We need some guidance there. I don't think it's fair to any defendants that the government can keep going back and raising this part of the case again and again, especially if there's a clear mandate from this court as to what needed to be done.
Okay, I think we understand your position, Mr. Ashton. Let's hear from Mr. Goodman. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Goodman. I'm with the United States Department of Justice, representing the appellee, United States of America. The district court properly treated this court's prior decision as a general mandate to resentence Pelleges. And the district court did not abuse its discretion when it reduced Pelleges' prison term from 600 months to 300 months, but increase the amount of restitution. There is no requirement in Rule 32 or elsewhere that a district court ask the probation office to prepare a new or updated pre-sentence report whenever a defendant is to be resentenced. Ordering a new PSR is a matter within the district court's discretion. Here, Pelleges' resentencing did not require a new PSR. Although the government said that it would not object if one were prepared, the court's decision did not vacate any of Pelleges' convictions, nor did it find any error with the original guidelines computation. This court instructed the district court to impose a prison sentence that was less than the prior prison term, which was tantamount to a life sentence. The district court did not need a new PSR in order to comply with that directive. Nor was the district court required to recompute the advisory guidelines range, as this court made clear in the recent Soucy decision. Even without a new PSR, the district court on remand was permitted, consistent with Pepper, to consider anew the sentencing factors in Section 3553A. The court could listen to any new sentencing arguments that Mr. Pelleges might advance under that section. And Chief Judge Conrad fully erred pledges to sentencing claims on remand. The court entertained sentencing memoranda, considered defense counsel's arguments, allowed Pelleggi to allocute, and analyzed this court's mandate. The result was a new prison sentence that was half as long as the prior sentence. Mr. Pelleggi has not shown how a new or updated PSR would have affected the court's analysis on remand. He's not directly challenging his new prison sentence on appeal, yet his request for a new PSR apparently relates to the guidelines calculation, not to the restitution amount. And even with respect to restitution, the PSR noted that restitution was mandatory. The government had already identified more than 600 victims and that it was in the process of attempting to locate additional victims.
Let me ask you this. The reason you asked the court to reconsider restitution is because you got additional information about concerning the amount of restitution between the time of your appearance
here. Well,
that
was part of it, Your Honor, but we knew from Yamas and the other unpublished decisions dealing with the Costa Rican fraud centers that the $4.2 million figure was invalid. If Pelleggi had appealed...
And that's because you got new information about...
Well, this court held, even without the new information, that the $4.2 million was an inappropriate figure. In one sense, it was too high because it was a consolidated figure dealing with victims from the dozen or more Costa Rican call centers. But in another sense, that $4.2 million figure was way too low because it only reflected claims that had actually been filed by victims in December of 2008.
So part of it was a change of the law.
That's right. The published Yamas decision came out 2 months after this decision, this court's decision in Pelleggi 1. So the United States really could not have accepted that $4.2 million restitution figure for Mr. Pelleggi because this court had already held that it was an invalid figure in all the other cases in which Judge Whitney imposed that composite figure. So the government was really compelled to go back and redo the restitution to attribute the amount of restitution that was solely attributable to the Pelleggi call center for the time frame in question, which was from the beginning of 2003 to May of 2006. And that's when the government obtained the additional information and did the more thorough five-generation analysis going from victims to runners and runners to victims and came up with the conceitedly significantly higher $20.7 million figure. But the government was required under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act to do its best efforts to locate and identify the victims and the specific amounts. And certainly Mr. Pelleggi, even though it was not in the PSR, was given in advance the new figures that the government had calculated. And there was really nothing else that the government could do. The government actually...
Yes, there's something you could do. The court could follow the mandate of this court. It had nothing to do with restitution. It was solely that violated the extradition treaty, the country, and that was the rule of the court, and the court was to revisit sentencing. There's nothing about restitution.
Well, it was silent about restitution, but it was remand for...
Sentencing, period.
For resentencing, an assignment to a new district judge.
I know that, but sentencing, period. Period. Now, you have anything beyond the period based on the opinion? I think I know a little bit about what we said.
Well, obviously, how y'all interpret your mandate.
That's right.
I can't.
I'm trying to get some interpretation beyond the period. Tell me what it was.
Well,
period.
I think Judge Conrad rightly viewed this.
I'm not asking you about Judge Conrad, the district court. It's not important to even name the district court judge. The district court. This court, what did we say beyond period? Sentencing, period. Fill it in.
And I think that the sentencing includes a package that, fine, terms of release after incarceration, forfeiture, it's a whole sentencing package, at least looking on the face of it, the court did not say simply impose a new term of imprisonment. Now, perhaps that's, and obviously from your question, that's what you all intended. Looking at it.
The only thing we were talking about, you didn't appeal the restitution, did you?
No, we did not appeal, and that's a question of waiver, but then we have the exception to the waiver principle for new controlling legal authority. And the Yamas case, which was published, and the other unpublished decision, did make it clear that...
You mean new case authority can change a mandate rule?
Well, it can...
In the case, so that means that, for example, a new case comes out, you could get a higher sentence just because another case changed it? You haven't appealed that issue?
It can take you out of waiver from not raising that claim in the first instance, Your Honor. Yes, that's one of the exceptions to the mandate.
That would be the case if you didn't do it at trial. It may take you out of waiver when you come up here on appeal, but after you lose on appeal and there's a mandate which becomes the rule of this case, you're saying that another case would just change our mandate?
If it's a controlling authority, yes. And what the Yamas and the other cases say is that the way the $4.2 million figure that was computed by Judge Whitney originally for this case and for the other Costa Rican sweepstakes fraud cases was computed, that was invalid, that took into account victims from multiple call centers, and you could only attribute the, for restitution purposes, the amounts for the individual call centers. So the $4.2 million figure on its face, it became apparent, was no longer a good figure.
Could it conceivably, on recomputation, have become less than the $4.2 million? In other words, the figure, the way it was computed the first time, you were looking at all of the call centers collectively. And what Lama said was, you can only attribute the loss to a defendant for the individual call center he participated in, as I understand it. So my question is, in computing, going back and recomputing, could the amount, when you go back and look just at the individual call center, that amount might have been less? Is that possible?
It is certainly possible, Your Honor, yes. But
you had already looked at all of them. So that case really didn't apply to you anyway. You had looked at all of them.
Well, we had not done as thorough a job of looking at all of them, Your
Honor. That's your problem. But you had looked at all of them. So it's even in opposite to say that case even applies to you. You can't have it both ways. The government, you got to do your job. We hold defendants to all kind of timelines and those things, no matter what. Well, you missed your deadline, 2255. You don't. But you come in and say, well, we just didn't do it thoroughly. We want to redo. It flies in the face of the mandate rule, the rule of lenity, and probably facto type issues too.
Well, I don't think it flies in the face of the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act.
Well, what flies in the face of the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act is the government's poor job the first time around of identifying the victims and their losses. And I don't say that, I really don't mean that critically. Government has a very difficult task here. But it could have done a better job the first time around.
Indeed.
I mean, you managed to come up with with another $16 million in losses from this one call center.
Well, of restitution for identified victims.
Yeah.
So here we have, now we have identified victims with dollar figures attached to them.
Right, and you could have done that back in 2006. You could have. The information wasn't created after the appeal. The information was always there.
The raw data was there, yes,
Your Honor. Yeah, sure. So your risk, your real risk, as I understand it, was you were afraid that after the remand, that the defendant would take a second appeal, as in fact he has, and in that second appeal, raise the issue of the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, right? That was your concern.
Well, it raised the argument, as the many defendants had raised, that the $4.2 million was an invalid figure. That's correct.
So you were concerned that the defendant might raise it in a second appeal, right?
Well,
that's why you convinced the district court to do a do-over.
We actually said, I think, before Judge Conrad, that we could live with the $4.2 million, but that the...
And you wanted the defendant to waive ex ante any challenge to that number, right?
Well, so we asked the court, we said that, in light of this court's rulings, not just in Yamas, but the other cases, that the $4.2 million was an improperly calculated figure, we then felt obligated to go back and do our best effort.
Oh, but no, I thought you actually offered to the defendant, my recall of the record is, you basically said to the defendant, look, why don't we just agree on $8 million and be done with this?
Well, the eight...
Is that reasonably accurate?
The $8.3 million loss figure, which was the basis not for restitution, but for forfeiture.
Forfeiture, right. So you wanted to do another eight on restitution, right? Is my recollection correct?
Well, I think it would be the same eight that we agreed, not eight plus eight, but...
The same eight. Right, so you were asking for another four. Right? You said, look, let's just work this out, agree to eight, be done with it, but the defendant wouldn't agree with that.
That is correct, right? Your Honor.
And no lawyer in his or her right mind would agree to that or recommend that to his client, correct? Didn't you agree with that? He had a mandate from this court essentially saying 600 months is too much. Pay attention to the treaty. Resentence. Well, how could a lawyer in those circumstances agree to foist another $4 million on his client for restitution?
Well, Judge Conrad certainly didn't read the mandate that way either, Your Honor.
I understand you prevailed upon Judge Conrad, but I don't see how you could expect a lawyer to say, yeah, we'll agree. Of course, the whole thing is academic discussion anyway, right?
Yeah, and that's an important point to recognize.
He's going to pay $200 a month on whatever the restitution is 25 years from now. Or I guess he's got
credit.
Well,
it's less than 25 years, actually, with the good time credit.
Right.
According to the Bureau of Prisons.
So he gets 2 months off. So he gets 50 months off of 25-year sentence.
His projected release date is in early 2028 when he'll be 68 years old.
By the way, have you executed on any of that forfeiture award? Has the government gotten any money? Has the government been able to wring any money out of this guy?
My understanding is not from Mr. Pileggi. I think there are some of the other...
I'm talking about from Mr. Pileggi. Yeah.
Right. So
yeah. Whether it's $4 million or $20 million, maybe he'll win Powerball. Are they allowed to buy Powerball tickets while they're in prison? Never mind.
Probably not while they're in prison, but, after he gets out of prison, and then, there is a provision that would allow, if he became a Powerball winner, for the... district court to revisit the $200 a month.
But the bottom line is, you were afraid, the government was concerned, that he might raise the restitution issue in the second appeal, and you wanted to put the thing to bed before a second appeal. Isn't that correct?
I think it was more, I would characterize it as the government believed that the $4.2 million figure was no longer considered by this court to be a valid figure and that it therefore had to go about...
But we didn't say a word about that $4.2 million figure,
right, but
in
you
the
did
first
remand
appeal.
For not only for resentencing, which could be encompass restitution, but also you reassigned it to a different district judge.
And what is the significance of that? What inference are you drawing from?
I am drawing that? The inference that there is a need for a fresh look at the sentencing package.
At the 600 months.
Well,
that's what the opinion is. That's what the appeal was all about.
Well, Your Honor, then we. You know, could have been stuck with the $4.2 million figure. You're right. And
then, the government would have been stuck, and the defendant would have been stuck.
And this
right?
court could have, even on plain air review, said, no, that's $4.2 million. We've held that figure repeatedly.
Has this court ever noticed plain error in a restitution order? You don't cite a single case for that, do you?
No, I'm not aware, but we know that some of those victims were not Pelleggi call center victims. So we had to do our best effort, and conceitedly we could have done it the first time, but we should not be faulted, nor should Judge Conrad be held to have abused his discretion in taking the evidence.
If Judge Conrad, if the district court misapprehended the mandate, that's not an abuse of discretion. Any judge in good faith can do that. That's an error of law.
Right. The mandate question is reviewed de novo. The amount of restitution is reviewed for abuse of discretion.
We don't get to amount if the mandate didn't put restitution on the table for the district court.
Right. But there was nothing in the court's first order that had to be read as saying only look at the sentence and not the other parts of the judgment.
The mandates of this court in criminal cases need to say, but we don't mean supervised release, we don't mean restitution, we don't mean special conditions. We got to do all that in the mandate when the opinion on its face is just about a 600-month sentence, the propriety of a 600-month sentence of incarceration. You don't really mean that.
You well, know. Certainly you could have done it.
Would you recommend that to the court? Is that the Department of Justice's recommendation to this court?
I'm not recommending one way or the other, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that I think Judge Conrad reasonably read the mandate as encompassing a de novo resentencing, and that the de novo resentencing would in encompass a recalculation of the restitution amount. And I hate to be the one to tell the victims who are listed with specific identified amounts that they are no longer entitled, even in theory, to restitution, Your Honor.
You hate to be the one to tell them that the government didn't do their work when they had 2 years before trial to do it.
Well, we think that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Ashton.
I'll be brief in light of the comments and colloquy so far, but we would certainly argue that the only mandate of this court was to reconsider the 600-month sentence based upon the erroneous premise that the judge had in fashioning the original sentence.
Well, what does the judge do? This case is sent back to him like it was in this case, and the only thing that's been addressed is the amount of imprisonment. But the law has changed with regard to a part of that sentence, which is restitution, which means it was figured wrongly originally. Now, does the mandate rule trump his responsibility to make sure the sentence he imposes complies with the law, or does he have to look anew at the restitution amount because the law's changed and the way to compute it is now different when it was done originally. What do you think a judge should do in that case?
Well, in that particular...
Because it looks to me like that's what we have to decide.
Well, first of all, I don't think that would trump the mandate rule. Also, the defendant did not...
So you would say the mandate rule trumps that even if it's...
Well, the defendant
differently
didn't,
now,
the
judge doesn't
raise
have the
that
authority to address that restitution issue.
Right. Well, the defendant didn't raise that issue. The issue was actually raised by the government. The way I sort of look at it, if he's getting a new sentence, we're going to try to raise the restitution. They filed the motion increasing it from $4 million to $20 million, which then put the defense counsel on the defensive, and he basically couldn't stipulate or agree to any figures. And I believe he was going back only worried about the 600-month sentence, and the government has argued here that since it was reassigned to a different judge, that ought to maybe possibly change the mandate rule. But the only reason it was assigned to a different judge, according to the last paragraph of the prior opinion, is that Judge Whitney had made the comment that he didn't think Mr. Pelleggi could ever be a productive citizen at any time in his life, and therefore possibly another judge maybe needed to look at it. But that should not open the door to every other issue that may be possibly raised at some time. And certainly the defendant would be the one that would raise the restitution issue. I would submit maybe possibly under Rule 22.5 later. Again, it might be all academic. But basically what's happened here is Judge Conrad applied the mandate rule to all of the other issues that might have arisen, but then didn't apply it to the restitution. And the government shouldn't have its cake and eat it too.
In fact, we're punishing the defendant for appealing and prevailing on appeal. Really, it's just the effect.
Well, in a way, it's to reopen way. Another issue since he actually prevailed in the first appeal and did get a significantly lower sentence. But again, the government did have all these facts and figures several years beforehand, and I can't stress that point more importantly.
Thank you, Mr. Ashton.
Thank you.
I suit you to keep going. All right, we'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our last case.